This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Wednesday, time to talk about your health. And it starts with something very close to home for me. Public health officials are investigating another outbreak of Legionnaires' disease. There have been 6 confirmed cases in a 1 kilometer radius of the intersection of Bathurst and DuPont, and that's basically just down the street from where I live. And so some of the people who live there or work there who visited the area have developed symptoms. So I'd like to know, what are the symptoms and who is at risk? Also, there's a breakthrough for many women who have gone through or are going through breast cancer. And most breast cancers are what is called estrogen receptor positive, which means they're fueled by estrogen. And that has meant that these women have been unable to take hormone replacement or other medications to ease the symptoms of menopause. And some of the treatments for breast cancer and also the drugs to prevent a recurrence actually make those menopause symptoms worse, sometimes a lot worse. Well, now there is a new drug for these women. It's called, and I'm looking, elinzanetant or Linquit, and it works in a different way, that is, without adding estrogen. And also, at the other end of the age spectrum, there's another kind of vaccine hesitancy that is taking hold, and this time it's new parents and their decisions about giving newborns a shot that used to be considered routine. So if you want to weigh in on any of these things or ask some questions, the numbers 416-360-0740 or 866-744-740. That is our text line and our long distance phone line.
Now time for the medical record.
And now let's go to Dr. Fahad Razak, a general internist at St. Michael's Hospital and Canada Research Chair in Healthcare Data and Analytics at the University of Toronto. Dr. Elisa Naiman, a family doctor practicing in Toronto, and Dr. Keith Stewart, Vice President, Cancer and Director of the Cancer Program at the Princess Margaret at the University Health Network. Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, Libby.
Hey. So, Fahad, let's begin with you. You are the public health guy. So what about this outbreak of Legionnaires' disease?
Yeah, so Legionnaires' disease, probably something that a lot of your listeners haven't heard about before. It is a bacterial infection that we first discovered in the 1970s. So there was an outbreak at an American Legion Hall of a pneumonia that spread across many people. And when they went to diagnose it, it wasn't a typical bacteria or organism. They found this specific bacteria that they've now named Legionnaires' disease and commemorating where it was first discovered. And over the years, we've seen outbreaks. It's always clusters, almost always clusters. It's not a disease that transmits from one person to another. It actually transmits through infected water droplets. And so you see it occur in things like buildings where the cooling system, the water, has been contaminated. You can have it happen in motor vehicles where people use it. For example, they're using water instead of windshield fluid, and that water is accumulating and sitting in that tank for a long period of time. And so whenever there's an instance of it, and I actually saw a case earlier this summer on the ward on my service, we had someone admitted. It's a public health notifiable disease because they want to track it back and see if they can identify an epicenter, a cause for why these infections are happening. In this case, there seems to be a cluster around a specific neighborhood. So, you know, you think about buildings in that neighborhood, you think about other areas of exposure. And the symptoms that people present with are typical pneumonia symptoms, with the added sometimes presentation of gastrointestinal symptoms. So when I teach my students, I say if someone comes in with pneumonia plus they're having diarrhea, for example, at the same time, let's send that additional test off to see if we're dealing with Legionnaire's disease. The test is very simple. It's just a urinary test for a specific marker. And then the treatment is very effective. So it's the classic pneumonia treatment, but it's an extended period. You have to treat for a longer period of time.
So what is the treatment?
So it's the antibiotic that we use could be something called, you've probably heard of Zithromax. So it's in that family. So it's in that family of antibiotics called macrolides, or another family, probably a little bit less known, called quinolones. We routinely use them in hospital. The reason it's important to know that it's Legionnaires is that we have to extend the treatment. The bacteria is a little bit harder to treat. So instead of treating for 5 to 7 days, we have to treat for 10 to 14 days.
Hmm. Okay. Very interesting. I know that there's talk that that maybe this comes from Castleview, Witchwood Towers, just down the street from me. And, you know, the copy says it's a long-term care home, which it is, but it's also a residence. People live there. So there are a lot of visitors come and go, and it's had previous outbreaks, but they haven't nailed it down, Elisa.
That's right. I think that maybe they might be thinking that it might be two separate outbreaks. I know that there is a TTC building that's nearby and that they were asked to clean out their water cooling system. But there also is an outbreak that's occurring at Witchwood. I've been there in terms of doing house calls to there. So in terms of it being a nursing home, but I wasn't aware that people also live there. But I don't know if you remember, but last year we talked about the same thing. There was an outbreak in London that took them a long time to figure out where it was coming from. And there's been outbreaks in the east end of the city as well. So it appears that every summer there's, because usually it's linked to a water source and an air conditioning or a water cooling tower, that every summer we do have a localized outbreak somewhere that they end up having to track back through contact tracing and find out where it is, and then to remediate usually a water tower.
Okay. It's would you say low risk to the public, even people who live around there?
I think that right now that they're saying that it's generally considered to be low risk. I think that if you have comorbid medical conditions, you're elderly, that your risk is higher. But right now, Toronto Public Health has conveyed that this is a low risk event for the general public.
Okay. Dr. Stewart, nice chatting with you again. Welcome back. This new drug to treat menopause symptoms for women who have breast cancer, estrogen positive breast cancer, it seems like a big breakthrough to me.
Well, yeah, thanks, Libby. I think as you already pointed out, it's about two-thirds of breast cancers are what we call estrogen receptor positive or hormone receptor positive. This means that they need estrogen the estrogen can produce growth in the tumor. So the way we treat those breast cancers is to use drugs which block estrogen and essentially cause menopause in women or menopausal symptoms. Women with breast cancer who have also received chemotherapy can often become postmenopausal as well. Of course, the issue for them is that the treatment usually, and my colleague Alyssa knows more about this than I do, is usually to give estrogen to women who are developing menopausal symptoms, which can be very unpleasant over many years. And these women, of course, can't take estrogen. So there's been a problem managing these patients as they survive. They often have to stay on these estrogen blocking drugs for 5 or 10 years prophylaxis after their primary surgery. So the advent of a drug which blocks those symptoms, I think, is a very important advance for those women. It will allow them to stay on the effective treatment and have less symptomatology. So very nice to hear about Health Canada approving it. I do want to point out to the audience, though, that it's, although it's Health Canada approved, it's not yet funded. And so there will be a gap between the Health Canada approval and the availability of the drug on a widespread basis.
Elisa?
So hot flashes are a problem for most females once they become perimenopausal or menopausal, with a significant amount of morbidity to someone's lives. It's very disruptive to one be having hot flashes throughout the day, and often people will not sleep well at night because they have terrible hot flashes, and it causes a significant impact on people's lives. So before, you know, there has been a renaissance in terms of treating people with estrogen, and estrogen is for menopause replacement therapy. So now most women will go on it, but that's in the last couple of years. So before this, we really would treat people with other medications, such as an SSRI, gabapentin, to help control their hot flashes. But there's a subset of women who, because they're not able to take estrogen, they continue to suffer. And so a couple of years ago, in Canada, there was approval of a medication within this class that provided an option for people to be able to have something to control their hot flashes. And now this is the second drug within the class that now has specifically been approved for this indication. The first drug wasn't so popular because in clinical trials, there was an impact on your liver. And so there was a rigorous liver enzyme testing that had to occur monthly for 3 months, and then every 3 months for a year. But this drug in trials, it doesn't show that. It was approved by Health Canada last year, and I don't think it's available in Canada on the market, even though it was approved, and now there's a specific indication. So this class has helped people, and it will be very beneficial for women who are unable to use estrogen. Same problem also applies for vaginal atrophy. It's a significant problem, and women who have estrogen receptor positive breast cancer are still being excluded from using a vaginal estrogen product. And it's unfortunate because it causes a lot of problems to people. It's very uncomfortable, predisposes you to getting urinary tract infections and all of the complications that can happen. So this is definitely good news because a lot of people do not sleep because they have terrible hot flashes.
So what is the trajectory likely to be, either Fahad or Keith? I mean, how long before it becomes readily available, assuming that it will?
Yeah, I'm going to leave this one for Keith. He's our expert.
Yeah, I'm not sure about this one. I mean, for a chemotherapy drug, it can often take a year or a year and a half before the public purse will pay for an expensive chemotherapy drug. I'm a bit less certain about the general approval basis for non-cancer medication. So I'm not sure I can answer that today, Libby. I would imagine it will be not that long. I would hope within a year would be my guess.
Is it an expensive drug? Does anyone know?
I have no idea. And as far as I know, there hasn't been a price issued on what this drug might cost to pay out of pocket.
So usually these drugs are about $1 to $2 a day. So for the one that came out earlier, it's not covered by the Ontario government. So it becomes either you're a private payer or you have third-party coverage. But generally there is good third-party coverage, but you do have to have a private health plan. I spoke to the Bayer rep maybe in April about this when I found out that it was coming to market. And like I said, it was approved by Health Canada last summer. So I think it's probably more of a marketing issue and just bring it into the country. She seemed to think that it would be here by now. So I'm assuming that it will be available hopefully very soon.
And another thing I want to point out is that, and especially for women who have gone through a lot of this with a lot of the drugs, that a lot of people think, you know, menopause is kind of one and done, but it isn't. It keeps recurring. And, you know, I have to say I've been through a lot of these drugs and I was lucky. But, you know, years and years later, you can get a whole recurrence and it can be worse than the original, right?
Right. So when I was in medical school, we were taught that, oh, you have hot flashes for a couple years and then it's done and you don't have to worry. So I think the average duration is about 7 to 10 years that some women will have hot flashes. Now, this is very variable. Some people will go through menopause and they'll have nothing. And then there's people who have debilitating hot flashes that impacts their life. Generally, it does settle down over the 7 to 10 period, but people will often report 20 years later that all of a sudden they're having hot flashes again. And then we have to do an investigation to figure out why are you having a hot flash and make sure you don't have a cancer that's causing you to have a hot flash. And often with a workup, we don't find a cause for the hot flash. And then we're trying to manage people's hot flashes. And then there's people who just from the time of menopause for the rest of their life, they continue to have hot flashes.
Yeah, and it's being taken a little more seriously these days, which I guess is good.
Absolutely. So before the pandemic and after the Women's Health Initiative study came out in 2001, nobody went on hormones and all of these women suffered. And now there's this cohort of women that are in their 70s who have gone 20 years without having any hormone replacement. And now you're not able to. So the general recommendation is 10 years post menopause, you should not be starting a menopause replacement therapy because of the cardiovascular risk, but you still do need to continue being on a vaginal estrogen product. And people say, how long do I have to take this? And I go, for the rest of your life. And they look at me like, what are you talking about? Mm. But there's this cohort of women in their 70s who unfortunately have a very atrophic, dried out vagina because they missed this opportunity because nobody was doing it at the time. And they suffer from recurrent urinary tract infections. They have terrible itchiness, burning. It's ongoing. And it's unfortunate that it's taken over 20, 25 years for menopause replacement therapy to come back and for people to be treated.
Okay. Well, I don't want to rehash all the history, but there was a flawed study that changed everything and then it changed it back. I want to get back. Interesting, Fahad, you were saying that for the Legionnaires' disease, you need a longer course of antibiotics, but I saw something and I think I remember something coming out a few years ago that said, actually, maybe you don't have to finish your antibiotics if you go on it. And I saw something in the last week that said sort of the same thing, that you can do with a shorter course of antibiotics.
Yeah, a lot of the, I think people may wonder, why do we constantly have this back and forth about duration of antibiotics? Legionnaires is one example, pneumonia, urinary tract infections. We talk about this a lot. What is the duration? We're trying to find this balance between eradication of whatever the infection is or enough suppression so that your body's immune system can take over versus the consequence of antibiotics themselves, which a lot of people have side effects, diarrhea, there's allergic reactions. There's a lot of things that people can get with antibiotics and broadly resistance. So, you know, one of the things that we see in the hospital increasingly, which is really terrifying, is infections where we no longer have an antibiotic that we can treat with, where we test every antibiotic available in the Canadian system or in the American system, and it's resistant to all of those. And broadly, the thing that drives at a system level, society, Ontario, Canada, the United States, Europe, that's driving overall patterns of where resistance is occurring is total volume of antibiotic use. So anything you can do to reduce volume safely, even at the individual patient level, is overall reducing the pressure. So I'll give you an example. Pneumonias are something that we can often push people to 5 days of treatment now, very effectively. When I started training, that was 7 to 10 days. And that is research that has pushed that down. Legionnaires, we don't have as much data on because it's rare. It is rare. It's episodic. It's clustered. We don't see it all the time. Still, for a patient sick enough to end up under me on a hospital ward, we tend to use longer treatment duration for Legionnaires. Whether that will reduce over time, that's a good question.
But I remember, and maybe still, is that when you get a bottle of antibiotics, like in big letters, you have to finish these even if your symptoms get better. So is that no longer true?
That is still true for essentially most infections. We give you a duration, 3 days, 5 days, 7 days, a single, whatever it is, follow that. there is emerging again some areas where we are modifying that duration based on symptoms. If you respond very quickly, sometimes we will reduce the treatment duration. For example, pneumonia in hospital, typically 5 to 7 days, we will push towards the 5 day, the lower course, like not completing your 7 days, if people have a very fast response. I would say that is, those are isolated. Those are sort of under the direct care of a physician. The general message to most people for most infections is finish your course.
Okay. I don't know if you have any anything to say about this next one, Dr. Stewart, but there seems to be another vaccine hesitancy instance, and this time it involves newborns who apparently are born with a deficiency of vitamin K, and it was routine to give them a shot when they were born, and now parents are refusing that.
Yeah, this is another sad example of disinformation. I think this has been standard practice to prevent a small number of children that are born with a vitamin K deficiency. And vitamin K deficiency leads to bleeding, and there's an increased risk of bleeding in the brain in some children. And in a fairly, a harmless injection of vitamin K essentially is the answer, and it's been standard practice across the world, really, for decades. I think this is part of the general story of anti-vax, anti-measles. People start to blame the excipients that the drugs are mixed with. They point out anecdotal cases, ignore the sort of general population good. It's a bit of a sad story, actually, in many ways. And I hope the medical community and shows like this will push back on this. This is a common sense a public health maneuver to prevent unnecessary deaths. And it joins a long line of, sadly, looking at the measles, incredible numbers of measles now in the United States, for example, just as a result of this disinformation.
Alisa, have you seen this in your practice?
So I haven't seen it in my practice, but I don't deliver babies, so I wouldn't be involved. But I haven't had a patient come to me and say, oh, I'm delivering and I'm going to decline having a vitamin K injection. So hopefully this isn't the stage where we are with vaccinations. This is another example of misinformation and influencers pushing this idea that there was a study in the 1980s that said that there was a correlation with vitamin K injection and leukemia, which was then debunked by further studies. But this information exists, and it's just manipulated and changed within the social media space that either there's still, you know, lies, things are being held back, and that you shouldn't be doing this. And it's just one more example that if you just continue to read information or hear information that's not true and you hear it over and over again, you start to believe that there is some validity to what is being said. And this is not true. And you're putting your baby at significant risk by not getting this IM injection at birth for developing a bleed later on, which, although rare, can be quite catastrophic. And it's really something that where this came from and where we're at today is beyond me. And people should feel very comfortable. This has been given for 40 years, that at the time of birth, you get an IM injection of vitamin K.
Hmm. We only have like a minute left. So Fahad, where does this come from? Is this TikTok? RFK? Where does it come from?
It's the whole ecosystem. RFK is a figurehead in an ecosystem that has social media. It has intentional disinformation that's driven by profit. People are trying to sell alternate products. It's from other countries trying to destabilize our countries. We can trace a lot of this back to specific misinformation campaigns that are coming out of places like Russia, for example, that are targeted at the West. It ties into this general idea. You know, what I hear often from patients is, you know, humans naturally didn't need this. Why are we doing these things? that period of time, pregnancy, birth, and the immediate period after it was one of the leading causes of death for humans historically. 50% of all of the life expectancy gains that we've had in the last 100 years have come from that exact time, preventing mothers from dying and babies from dying. And so this idea of natural, yes, I agree, naturally many mothers died and so did babies die. And we have ways to prevent that now. So I think it's a constant battle, and it has certainly become much more difficult in the last few years.
Okay, yeah. I'm sorry we have to keep talking about it. On that note, we're going to wrap things up, though. Thank you so much, Dr. Fahad Razak, Dr. Keith Stewart, and Dr. Alisa Naiman. And we'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
See you, Libby.
Okay, we are taking a break. And when we come back, so there was a reprieve late last night. Those 50% tariffs that were supposed to kick in on $28 billion worth of our exports to the U.S., well, we have a reprieve for 3 days. So is it really good news? Is it just like a little stay of execution? We will talk to trade expert and lawyer Dr. Barry Appleton when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Oh, no. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, is it really good news or just the equivalent of a stay of execution? Late last night, Donald Trump announced that he would delay those new 50% tariffs that were set to kick in. He was going to delay them by 3 days. Now, he said there is a deal that just needs to be finalized, while our Prime Minister Mark Carney says there's still a lot of work to be done. Now, meanwhile, U.S. trade officials have released some information, and they say they are getting concessions in dairy access, autos, and provincial alcohol bans. Now, yesterday, we got a lot of great information from international trade expert, lawyer Barry Appleton, and we're going back to him to get his take on what this likely means. Let me give the numbers out again if people want to ask or weigh in. 866-740-4740 is our text line, our long-distance phone line, also 416-360-0740. And Barry, thank you so much for coming back today.
I'm delighted to be here, but the circumstances are a little bit stranger than I expected.
Okay. So what do you make of this?
Well, look, this was a pressure exercise, right? The Americans pulled these tariffs on Canada for the purpose of extracting something. They wanted to get some form of deal at the table. So that is exactly what they got. Okay? This is not by accident. This is by design. The tariffs that they had been proposing at 338s were horrific tariffs. They were designed to inflict as much damage as possible. And there could be more tariffs after this. So that was the plan. The question entirely was, why was Canada not saying yes to something? And the reason was is that they lowballed us, right? They came in and offered us too little for our car. And we said, no, we're not going to sell. And then the question really is, but I need a car really badly. And for Canada, we need access to the U.S. market really badly. And even more important, we need to have some certainty. So those are the types of things you need to judge. Did we get what we want to get? And is 3 days enough? Did we buy enough time? That's part of the question. So that's what we're going to figure out.
But I was kind of surprised that U.S. trade officials released a little bit about what's in the deal. And it looks to me that it's got things that the prime minister can't promise because it's kind of up to the provinces for things like provincial alcohol bans, which is one of the big irritants there.
Well, the prime minister's been promising provincial stuff for in all of these talks. The only reason he could get anywhere is by promising that. Now he's got to deliver. Now, the good news is we're very efficient in Canada because our U.S.-Canada trade minister also is our minister of intergovernmental affairs. So you don't have to brief two ministers. You got one who's in the room. But so much of this deals with the need to get the provinces on side. And the provinces have said, we're not going to come on side until you clean up the big issues, and those are softwood lumber, which is not even in the discussion, steel, aluminum, and autos. So we're in a bit of a funk, and I don't think the 3 days is going to cut it. But so that's issue number one. Issue number two, and this is one that's more interesting, is why didn't the prime minister tell us what was in this? Why do we have to hear from the Americans? Because the Americans think they got something really big on Canada. That's why they did this. And I think the prime minister is not entirely happy. And by the way, Libby, on your list, you missed, we've given up everything on digital. We've given up our streaming. We've given up our content. We've given up our cultural sovereignty when it comes to all the modes of communication. And we've given up AI. Now, alignment means control. Okay, alignment doesn't mean, oh, let's check our watches at the same time. That's all called interoperability or mutual recognition. Alignment means the U.S. sets the rules and Canada's going to follow them. I would think that's a pretty big ask, and I didn't even know it was there. So there's a lot of explaining that we need to have, and Canadians really need to get in this process. And right now we're all shut out of the process. And that's different from the Mexicans. They brought everybody in. So there's more than one way.
So final question before we see how this plays out. So the provinces have to be on side, and I guess it's a political question. Is Doug Ford going to think that this deal is good enough for him to put the booze back on the LCBO shelves? Is that what it comes down to? And
yes.
And the dairy access, I mean, that is holy grail in Quebec.
So and what's missing is softwood, which is the entire game in BC. So you have at least three huge issues, all that need to be done, no answers. In fact, not even softwood isn't even being discussed. I can't see how a deal can happen in three. So the real question is, do we get yet another rollback? And remember, this isn't taco. This isn't Trump chickening out. This is Canada paying all types of prices to buy more time at the parking lot. And it's got to be worthwhile. That's what we got to figure out. And it's a real good question, a really big one. And I'm sure your listeners all have something to weigh in, too.
Okay. So I guess we just see what happens Friday. Hopefully this doesn't wreck our weekend.
It's going to be like a rinse and repeat, right? It's going to all come to that last minute. It's going to be a question of what will you pay again to not have these massive, massive tariffs ruin your weekend? Before it was, what are we going to do to have it not ruin our week? And as long as we're prepared to pay, the Americans are prepared to accept. But it's going to run out. And what else is on our list? We don't know.
Okay. It keeps on going on. Barry, thank you so much for your insight. Really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me.
Okay, bye-bye. All right. We're taking another break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about something that I know a lot of Zoomers will identify with. And my guest is here in studio. It's my husband, Doug. And it's about trying to get rid of your stuff, to give it a good home, things maybe you inherited, things maybe you paid a lot of money for, things that were valuable, and now you can't give it away. So I'm going to give the numbers before we go to break, because I bet a lot of people have a lot of stories in this vein. So our text line, 866-744-740, and our phone line, 416-360-0740. And tell me about your stuff when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, now we go to another story that is very close to home and something many Zoomers will really identify with. And this is trying to pass on our stuff. Stuff, things that used to be considered valuable, that includes family heirlooms that we may have inherited, that we were respectful of, that we kept in the family, or it might be things that we paid a lot of money for. There are also things that we, not so long ago, used to be able to sell for lots of money. And at the top of this list is what young people call brown furniture. Well, now you can't give it away. My husband, Doug Gould, hi, sweetie. Is here.
Maybe a long time no see. I wish this was a little happier story than the trade story we just heard from Barry, but I'm afraid it isn't. And a lot of the stuff that used to be worth a lot of money is now essentially radioactive. So I think I just handed you an assessment of brown furniture that I inherited from 1972 from a top auction house, and it was assessed at $22,000. And you said that's now worth what?
It's almost $176,000.
And I managed to sell half of it, three rooms worth, in 2008. I sold it for $22,000, so that's a pretty good return. But lately, I've had less good luck.
Okay, so the idea for this story came to me when one day I came home just a few days ago. And Doug was thrilled that he finally was able to get rid of four chairs by putting them out on the lawn.
Well, that's that.
And how did you tell the story of trying to give those chairs away and find them a good home?
Right. So I started at the top of the list. I contacted a high-end antiques dealer I dealt with in the past. Yeah. He shrugged and basically said, not interested and worth nothing. They're basically four late Victorian chairs, quite attractive, quite sturdy, need recovering, which is a problem because it costs a lot of money. It could be up to, $400 or $500 per chair to recover them. So the auction dealer wasn't interested. I then looked at the furniture bank, saw what they had in inventory, thought they wouldn't be interested.
Okay, let's just say, what's the furniture bank? They're a charity and they...
They're a charity, and I just looked at what they had in stock, the kind of thing they were selling. I decided they weren't worth trying. Instead, I tried Habitat, which have something called a Restore, Habitat for Humanity. I sent them, filled out the application form. I sent them photos of the chairs, and I got a very polite letter back, thank you for thinking of us, and across the top was in big type, canceled. So they don't want that. You can't even give it to them. If you want them to pick it up, three pieces of furniture is $150. Four pieces to seven people, seven pieces is $300, $150, $300, and $700 if you've got, I think, nine pieces. So it's even expensive to get rid of this stuff. And then finally, and here is the bottom of the barrel, but a solution, I put all four chairs out in front of our house in our neighborhood, and they were gone in 45 minutes.
Okay, well, at least you were able to do that because, in the last few years, people have started these businesses getting rid of your stuff for you. And you have to pay. And the prices you just quoted, that is not cheap.
That is not cheap. And even worse, if anyone has a library or books in the basement, boxes, you can't give books away either unless they're current bestsellers. I used to teach at university. Academic books are worthless. You can give them to a colleague in the same line of study. But basically, people don't want books. And of course, they take up a lot of space. So again, my solution was put them in a box out in front of a house with a sign on it, please take them. And by the way, when the four chairs disappeared last week, they even took the sign with it.
I mean, the only thing I would argue with there is that they are attractive. And I mean, Victorian stuff, over the years, a lot of this stuff kind of lived in the basement. We have an unfinished basement. And what made you decide that you want them out of the house?
Well, we've had, as you point out, the stuff's been sitting down there for decades. They're chairs I actually used to sit in when I grew up, and they weren't that bad. But now, first of all, I think particularly younger people, as you mentioned, don't like the look of them. They're heavy, they're dark wood, and to be perfectly honest, they're not very comfortable. And, I think people, as they get older, like to you know, simplify their life, simplifies their living space. And I had the good or bad fortune to have five careers. One of the small mistakes in my life was keeping everything, old university notes, old university books, actually everything in sight. And now I'm sick of seeing the stuff around the house. I either want bare space or new stuff, but not the stuff I grew up with.
Okay. And I remember things that have disappeared over the years. I've got an email here from Chris, and she writes that she's been trying to get rid of her stuff on Facebook Marketplace, and that is selling it. And she did manage to sell some stuff, but not a single taker for a complete set of Noritake china, which is our vintage. It's what we would have bought when we started our households. Also, don't ask about the vintage porcelain fish decanter set, which I thought was fashionable just in the last few years.
And the sort of things people used to get as wedding presents, you know, all that crystal, all that china, all that fancy stuff that they used on Sunday, if they used it at all. Nobody wants that anymore. To be perfectly honest, I don't want it either. And I'm older, and younger people, I think, just can't stand it. Don't like the look of it. Don't like the feel of it. Think it's too special.
Okay. I'm going to take a call from Daryl in Toronto. Hi, Daryl.
Hi there. How you doing? Anyway, just recently I sold boxes and boxes of books from my late brother's apartment that I had emptied out when he passed away. And there is a company that buys stuff like that, if you want to know.
You got money for it? For yeah. Books?
Yeah, books, CDs, DVDs.
I think...
How much did you get?
First there were like about 35 boxes of books. The first batch they took, they gave me $725 for. And then the second batch, because some of them had gotten back here, I got another basically $1,000.
Wow.
For the books and the DVDs and CDs. So, you know, there are places.
Free money.
We are very impressed, Daryl. We do want to hear
it from you.
It wasn't exactly free money because I had them in storage for a while. And that's a whole other scam going on there. If you're in storage for 6 months, they start raising the price on you over and over and over again because they know you don't want to move it. So finally, I decided to empty out the locker and found this place. I think it's. Do you want the name of it?
Sure.
Okay. I think it was BMV. I have a phone number here too. If you want,
maybe give us a text with that. Okay. Appreciate that. So yeah, storage. So people put things in storage that they're never going to take out of storage. And I remember. In our family, we had basically no heirlooms. My parents came here in 1948 as displaced persons. But our aunt, who went through the war, she lived in Shanghai. And then she moved to Zambia. And she had one very heavy piece of furniture that was her prized possession. And it was a stinkwood chest. And we had that shipped from Britain, and it cost a fortune to ship it. And then you look at it, it's like, why did I want this?
I also moved, since I taught at university, moved from Vancouver to Edmonton to Ottawa to Hamilton to Toronto and lugged all this furniture around. So stuff that I didn't even want, I inherited. I must have spent a fortune just in storage charges and moving charges. And in retrospect, it was all a terrible mistake.
Yeah, but, you know, the other thing I wonder about is a lot of these things go in and out of fashion. Though, you know, those Victorian things, it's hard to imagine that they ever come back in fashion. But, you know, you never know. Right now, anything mid-century modern is in fashion.
You're right about never knowing. So I also had some, I thought, pretty selective books that I inherited, leather covers, poems of Byron, first edition from 1880 or whatever. I went to a high-end dealer 6 months ago or whatever. He wasn't interested in any of them, and I happened to throw in some books I had as a child, from the 1950s, first edition of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, if you can imagine that, from the 1930s.
Oh, yeah.
He loved it. and some other children's books, first editions, snapped them all up and gave me a very good amount of money. So you just never
I didn't
know.
Hear about that, Doug.
There you go.
That's the first I've heard about that. Yeah, we've talked about that first edition of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer when we cover things at Christmas time.
That's right. That's right. And because this is kind of a bleak discussion, you just never know what you have. So when I was cleaning my brother's house out in 2008 in the beaches here in Toronto, there was a painting no one wanted. It was over the mantelpiece. I thought it was kind of saccharine. It was a little girl oil painting carrying a bucket on a beach, you know, with sand at her feet. I was literally going to put it out in the garbage, and the high-end dealer I mentioned happened to show up. I think he was paying me some money, and he looked at it and he said, "Do you mind if I take it?" And I said, "Sure, go ahead." I was going to give it to him. It turned out it was an obscure Dutch painter from the 1880s. The painting was worth $12,000.
Wow.
I would have given him $11,000. He said, "I'll take $4,000, a third of it." And I said, "You're welcome." And I collected $8,000 from something that was 5 minutes away from ending up in the garbage.
Okay. You hear those stories all the time. You know, I think generally worth talking about is what makes us, or when do you get to the point where you really want to get rid of things, to get them out of the house? It kind of, you know, we lived with a lot of these things for a very long time.
Well, we didn't, because they were just put in the basement. The basement's crowded with junk. It's sort of, I find, mentally wears on you after a while. And my motive in all of this was not to try to raise any money. I kind of gave up on that a long time ago. But to find stuff that I thought deserved historically to be preserved a good home. And I've managed to do that for a number of pieces. I also had a pre-Confederation dining room table, quite beautiful. I think it was cherry wood, drop leaf, spindle legs, very fancy. And I ended up literally wheeling it to a neighbor's house. It was on tiny little wooden wheels. And it's from the 1860s. And I just didn't want it turned into Kindlewood. I didn't want any money for it. And it's now gracing the dining room of a neighbor. So that's
a
good ending.
And they're not opening it. I was going to bring that table up because we lived with that table for a very long time.
We did.
The thing about it was the way it's constructed, it's awkward when you have, you know, 8 people for dinner or 10 people for dinner, because it creates this very uncomfortable, very small space in the middle. And we have some good friends who are very small women.
Right.
And I always felt bad that we always stuck them in those tiny little spots. And I was surprised when you agreed for us to, I wouldn't say get rid, but to change that table to something that's a little easier to deal with.
Well, one of the other problems is people don't like probably the heavy wood, the look of the heavy wood, the darkness of it. But it doesn't just look heavy. It is heavy. So it's hard to move. It's hard to store. It's expensive to store. And even just changing it around, changing the configuration of your dining room or living room with this furniture is tougher than it would be with lighter, smaller, more compact furniture that's made more recently. So there's no good answer to this. I would simply say that you have to get rid of your thoughts of making a lot of money out of this and just think, I want to give a good home to this stuff. I want to give books to people that are going to read them. I want to give furniture to people that are going to use it so it doesn't end up in the garbage or, in the case of furniture, kindling wood.
Okay, I'm going to read a text from Barty, and she writes, "I have 2 large suitcases of pure silk and pure chiffon saris and Indian suits. Is anyone interested? Want a good home for them? I don't blame you. I have some saris as well. And I remember, Doug, years ago, what year was it that you brought some silk from Indonesia for me?
Oh, that's right.
That I was going to have made into things.
That would be the late 1990s when I was writing the book on Briaks, and a lot of it was quite beautiful, but things like that, what do you end up doing with them? What do you end up doing with wedding presents of, you know, an ugly vase from 25 years ago, which, by the way, we have a box of stuff like that in the basement, or several boxes. So at a certain point, you just have to say, I want to simplify my life. I don't want this stuff. I'm not using it. It would be great if somebody else could use it. If I make a little bit of money along the way, so much the better. But other than that, a lot of stuff these days, I think people want to buy them themselves and not inherit something from somebody else, however
well,
cheap it is.
It's also, spaces are smaller. And a lot of this stuff is big. But the other thing is, and oh, I've just lost my train of thought, but yeah, you just can't give some
stuff
of this
away.
Stuff. You just can't give it away. And it's so interesting that 18 years ago, you were still making money from it. And now you have to pay money just
That's right.
to get
and
it out the door.
To go back to when we were talking about storage, my experience with storing anything is if it's in storage, unless it's there commercially, but just as a private person, if it's in storage, you'll never see it again and you'll never use it again. So you're just wasting money on monthly fees, probably with the vague idea, someday I'll look at it or someday I'll use it. My experience is that's never going to happen.
Well, yeah, and those storage places, they're also become very good businesses. And again, as people put it in storage and such a headache to move it. Anyway, Doug, we'll see what is going out the door next. But I think a lot of people are facing the same thing. We've got 30 seconds. Like, what do you want to say about what, or tell me what's going next?
What's going next? Well, we've got, when we did renovations in the second and third floor, I moved, count them, 150 book boxes of stuff in the basement. I've got rid of about 80 of those boxes. I'm not sure what to do with the rest, but my guess is they're never going back upstairs. So they're either going in the garbage or somebody's going to inherit them.
Okay. Thanks so much, Doug Gould, my husband, on trying to get rid of stuff. And thanks for the callers and texters for their suggestions. This is, you know, something that affects us all. That's all the time we have for Fight Back for today. I'll be back here tomorrow, and we'll talk then.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.